All right. Well, thank you everybody for coming. I'm Cody Ray Anderson from the Office of Communications and External Relations, the Web Communications team. This presentation is going to be about, as it says on the board, writing for the web, specifically the sort of guidelines and strategies that we use in our capacity as sort of a unit that works on a lot of websites around the university, in writing effective content for the web that accomplishes the goals, again, both the goals of the university and the goals of the various units we work with. So as some people are still filtering in, I'll just start off by talking a little bit about our unit and what we do. We are in the, as I said, Office of Communications and External Relations. And among other duties, I think I may have seen a few of you previously at Lunch and Learns I've given on Google Analytics. We administer the Google Analytics system for McGill websites. We'll sit down with you and discuss what the results are and basically provide traffic reports for your site. As well, we work directly with units, both in a consultative role and in a more sort of hands-on capacity to help redo your unit's website and web presence, both at the sort of tactical level of individual pages and writing for the web, the level of information architecture, sort of how your site's set up and arranged, and even helping with broader communication strategy where that's appropriate. Near the end of the presentation, I'm going to put up our sort of unit email address in case any of you would like to get in touch about setting up a consultation or maybe something further. As well, I'm going to give you the address for a new site we actually just set up. It only went live yesterday, called Web 101, which covers, along with quite a lot of the stuff that I'm going to cover in this lecture on writing for the web, but also basically where the sort of IT knowledge base tells you how to set up a website on sort of the technical. People coming in. our Web 101 site kind of endeavors to provide a central resource for how to set up a website well in a way that accomplishes your unit's goals. Now, just before I start off, can everybody in the back hear me? Am I good? All right. Excellent. If at any point during the lecture or during the presentation, I should stop calling it a lecture, you have any questions, please just feel free to raise your hands if you'd like any sort of more concrete examples. I'd be happy to provide them. All right. Oh, and there will be 15 minutes or so at the end for general questions. All right. Well, let's begin. So the first step in writing for the web is really not writing at all, which is to say it's vital that you plan before you start writing. Sometimes our instinct is to just kind of, you know, get some words down on paper or screen. But frequently, you'll get a much better result if you start by planning what you're going to write, what goals it has to accomplish. And specifically, one of the most useful starting points for writing for the web is defining who you're going to be writing to, thinking about what they know, what they need to know, and keeping them in mind while you're writing. This means, to take sort of a concrete example, if your site mainly appeals to current students, you're probably going to want to adopt a pretty matter-of-fact and un-sort of jargony approach to writing. Whereas if you're, say, writing a page for prospective students, you may want to give it a bit more of a marketing kind of tone, where you're actively kind of trying to sell what whatever it is your unit is. As I was saying, you need to consider the goals of the web page that you're writing. What do you want the reader to do or to think as a result of going through your website? And finally, it's important to boil it down on a page-by-page level as to what the most important thing is that you're trying to say. So once you've planned out what you're trying to accomplish, you can ask yourself some questions about the content that you put together. If your page's goal is to inform the reader, ask yourself if the way you've written is skimmable and easy to understand. We'll go over some strategies to help accomplish this in a web context a bit later. Does it tell the user everything she needs to know? And if there's any additional information beyond what you've provided on the page or what you're going to provide on the page, make sure that the visitor's path to that additional content is clear. So sort of in the planning stages, one of the things you should see is whether the goal is to, as I said, inform or to spur action. So a page that's meant to inform people would be something like requirements for a course or sort of an application process or something like that, where it's sort of the user is seeking out this information of their own sort of volition. On the other hand, if your page's goal is to spur action, your the kind of goals that you're going to try to set for the page are going to be a bit different. So this would be something like you're trying to get people to register for an event, or that's probably the best example there, getting people to register for something. Then it's very important that visitors have an obvious immediate path to the desired action. What this usually means is, again, taking the example of registering for an event, making very, very prominent how it is that they do this. If the page's goal is to spur them into registering the event, then there's no reason the Register Now button shouldn't be the biggest thing on the page, basically. Further, it's important if this is the goal of your page to make very clear the what I call here the sales pitch. The reason for why somebody would want to do this is clearly laid out right away in hopefully in as few words as possible. Now we'll move a bit further into the sort of nitty-gritty of writing for the web. I'm wondering if anybody has any questions at this stage. All right. So the photo here is from an eye-tracking study, where the sort of hotter red areas are where people sort of read the most on the page, and the colder yellow and blue areas where they read less. One thing to note on here is that it kind of resembles an F. The attention of the user is focused at the very top of the page, whereas the rest of the body is skimmed. It's a little bit difficult to see here, but where there's sort of a concentration of attention here, this is a bulleted list where each item has one of these bullets next to it. And these are pretty common sort of patterns you'll see in how people pay attention to things. So what do we learn from this? The lessons we can kind of get from studies like this are that users are essentially impatient, don't like to read, and they're looking for clues to help them do what they want to do, and above all, they don't want to work. reading a website should not be hard work. Generally speaking, and this applies probably more to pages that have that goal of informing the user, what the visitor wants is just the facts. They want their information presented clearly and concisely. Once again, it comes up that skimmable content is very important because of the way, again, people sort of focus attention sort of sparingly on different parts of the page. And a single obvious and easily followed path to the information that they want, if it's not right there in front of them. So one way we can work towards accomplishing this is basically by cutting down the length of passages of text. And there's really there's no reason not to be very judicious with this, as is sort of in this example that we've given here, where the 79-word original version gets edited down to 31. The difference between the edited version and the original version, I'll show an example after this that highlights the words that were removed, is basically just that it uses... It follows the principles of just presenting the facts and presenting this information very clearly and concisely. So here's a similar example with the words that were removed in the original version highlighted in red. I don't know if it would be helpful for me to probably wouldn't be helpful for me to read this out. It's quite verbose, but you can see. The change that can be made. Somebody seeing the second version on a page will be much less likely to be sort of intimidated by what they're seeing. Any questions on that so far? No. Okay. Separate from that, another sort of strategy we can employ here is to break up the text and sort of make it more breathable, so to speak, by pulling content out again into bulleted lists, which people pay a lot more attention to, especially on the web. Keeping paragraphs quite short, using headers. Where appropriate, so this helps towards making things skimmable, but make it very clear what kind of information is appearing below that header. Excuse me. So an example here. So this isn't technically a header; it's not in the header font, but it accomplishes the same goal by saying. What you're going to find in this section is the topics that will be covered. All of this. Oh, yes.
I was told that we should preferably use the bold character over the underlined character because it's easier to read.
I there's actually a slide coming up about that.
The main reason for that is that, especially on the web, underlined text is. It generally denotes links. I'll get to that when that slide comes up a bit later. I'll expand on that. Any other questions? Great. Okay. In general, the way we want to write our web pages is in a style of sort of the inverted pyramid, as I've put up here. First, you have to explain what's on the page and why it's important. That's accomplished by these headers. So it's the very sort of broadest sort of application of the writing on the page. And then in the text of the page, you have to give the visitor what they came for. Whether that be, again, information on, say, courses or something like that. And then include any secondary details. Now, the secondary details might be necessary and important, but if they're very narrow, if they're very narrow in their application, then you just need to make sure that the users who need to see it will end up seeing it. and that it doesn't distract from sort of the broader goals of the page. That was a little bit abstract. I wonder if, does anyone have any questions on that? Okay. Now, as far as sort of strategy for content on a website in general, one thing that we really try to stress is not to duplicate content either across your own McGill website or content that's coming from other McGill websites. One thing we happen to see a lot is information that's housed in our e-calendar and the study calendar being sort of copied out and presented on individual websites. The problem with this is basically it's twofold. There's the maintenance problem, which is that whenever you kind of copy, put the same information in two places, it means it always has to be updated in two places. But sort of following from that is there's an issue for the user where if one version differs slightly, it's going to potentially be confusing and basically they won't know which version of the content is up to date. Now, obviously, if you're able to maintain it 100% accurately and reflect any changes, this shouldn't be a problem. But even so, even the smallest changes can cause confusion for people. Finally, it just makes a website more cluttered than it needs to be. Usually, if you're duplicating content and putting it in more than one place, it almost always makes more sense to link to the page that the sort of source page that this information is coming from, or the one page on your site where it's going to live. That said, there are always going to be exceptions to this. Fortunately, for anybody, I assume a lot of you are working on the WMS Drupal system. And the WMS Drupal system provides functionality with blocks that alleviates some of the concerns for this. Primarily the concern about having to update it in more than one place. So if you create a block for, say, a notice or a reminder that you want to put on every page of your site, or to take an example from before, a block to register for an event, you can basically create the block in one place and place it on multiple pages and only ever have to update it in the one place. It's also helpful because we can, depending on who the audience is, we can often assume with people who are more familiar with the McGill site that there's certain kinds of content that they expect to see in these blocks, and they kind of expect it to be similar across pages, and the same information appearing in two places potentially won't be as confusing. For information on sort of the nitty-gritty of working with blocks and putting them together, you can refer to the IT knowledge base at kb.mcgill.ca or from the IT website. Also on that Web 101 site that I mentioned earlier, there's a bit more information on working with blocks as well. I'll bring that up again at the end. With the site address for everybody's reference. Any questions on all that so far? Okay. And please let me know if I'm going too fast or if I'm going too slow, whatever. Now on to your question, actually, regarding formatting. Formatting is best done in small doses, essentially. And that's because each of them sort of presents trade-offs. Italicized text conveys emphasis, but it's also difficult to read, especially when you're talking about an entire paragraph, an entire block of text. Similarly, bold text is less difficult to read, but it's also kind of just like jarring. It stands out more than anything else on a page, and really draws the eye. Admittedly, sometimes you'll want to, often you'll want to draw people's eyes to things, but there's usually better ways to do it than by bolding an entire passage. As I mentioned, underlined text should, in almost every case, be avoided unless it's like a stylistic kind of thing. And that's simply because it's very easily confused with hyperlinks, especially if we're talking about users who have difficulty seeing color. It can present problems for people with color blindness. Just going back to sort of drawing people's eyes in a bad way, it's almost always a bad idea to use fully capitalized text in body text. And usually you want to avoid it in headings. You'll see it in places like the sort of sidebar block titles by default. And it again, it's effective in drawing people's eyes, but when used sort of too much, it really makes it difficult to read and just generally doesn't look very good. And finally, you don't want to use more than one exclamation point. I think the main reason for that is just sort of editorial style, I think. It's just, there's really nowhere where that's appropriate. In our office, we use the Globe and Mail style book, which we'd obviously recommend if you're looking to standardize that across your communications. Yes?
In a title, would you capitalize every word or just the first word?
This is a good question. The last time I gave this talk
last year, I believe the same question was asked, and I should have added a slide about it. There are sort of differing schools of thought on that. Generally, what we'll do is use sort of sentence case. So we'll capitalize the first letter unless it's the name of something, unless it's a proper name. I don't think we have an official position so much as sort of a house style on that, but that would be my recommendation. Any other questions? Yes.
One best practice for formatting is the use of sans-serif fonts for main text. And at present, as far as I know, WMS doesn't allow for
nope.
that. Do you know if that's going to be changed to improve readability if we build websites?
I don't think it is. And
at least from what I understand on that topic, the sort of received wisdom about it. So sans-serif... For those who don't know, sans-serif fonts are like here, like without sort of the bits on the end. I don't know an easier way to explain it than that.
Flourishes.
So like this, this is, I think, Calibri, Arial, Helvetica, those kinds of fonts, whereas Times New Roman, Georgia, which is the font that's used in McGill's body text, Garamond, fonts like that, those are serif fonts. The received wisdom, from what I understand, for use on screens is that sans-serif fonts are easier to read, but that serif fonts actually are not that much more difficult to read and actually increase retention of information. This was a study I read about like a couple of years ago, maybe more than that, and it might not be it might be out of date, but from my understanding, the difference isn't huge, and it was a stylistic choice to go with sans-serif headings and serif body text that's, I think, unlikely to be sort of reversed at any point in the future, unfortunately. I hope that answers your question. Okay. Anything else? All right. Once again, we have more information on this and sort of a central reference in case you'd like to look at back at it in the future on our new Web 101 site, which I'll show at the end and provide the URL for anybody to note that's interested. Yes. The Drupal WMS system has a lot of presentation features that are, once you sort of learn how to use them, it's tempting to use them everywhere. You'll have column displays where text or images can be sort of displayed side by side in two or three or four or five columns. Accordion sliders, which are where you click on them, they open up. Tabbed content, which is sort of similar. These are all potentially very useful and potentially very attractive features to use, but it's important to exercise moderation. Columns really primarily affect the way a user views a page, and it may be more confusing for them than helpful to have the content in columns, depending on what kind of content it is. Usually, if it's just straight up sort of text, there's not much reason to break it up into two columns unless it's following some other kind of scheme. Whereas if sort of the text in each column has a different heading, for example, one's for undergraduate students and the other's for graduate students, as long as that's clearly indicated, that's a perfectly valid use of the columns. Accordion sliders will hide content from your users. As I see here, in the middle or the top of the inverted pyramid, the middle or the widest part of the pyramid, it really shouldn't be in a slider. If it's something that potentially everyone needs to see, it really shouldn't be in a slider. Tabbed content kind of has elements of both of the drawbacks and some of the advantages. It's a real change from how people are used to viewing a page, and I'll just say that I haven't seen many cases where it's done well, which I don't mean as a challenge, but I'd use those with extreme caution, and unless there's sort of a good reason, a very well-defined reason to use them, I'd recommend against them. I'd recommend they don't replace the sort of hierarchical way of structuring a page where you have sort of the top headings and then subheadings to those top headings. Any questions on those? I don't have. All right. Another thing that's covered on our Web 101 site for anybody who'd like to have a reference point for those. Page anchors are extremely useful. They can greatly reduce the amount of scrolling that somebody has to do on a page. So, yes? I can give an example of page anchors. Why don't I? I know you're all hotly anticipating seeing the Web 101 site, so I'll bring it up. Page anchors generally appear like this. Where you have at the top of the page something like a table of contents, where if you click on one of the links, it brings you down, partway down the page. You can also use this to link to certain sections on other pages. For instance, if I wanted to link to the audiences section from the front page of the Web 101 site, I could copy the address that's in the address bar there. Oh, there we go. Okay. So these can greatly reduce scrolling. They can act as a table of contents so that as soon as somebody opens up a page, they know what they're going to find on there, even if not all the headings fit on the one page, and tells people that other items are below, as I was saying. For more information on how to create those, I can refer to the IT knowledge base. And I believe we've also got a little bit of information on the Web 101 site on the best ways to use them in case you would like to reference that in future. I actually gave an entire 45-minute talk on information architecture, but I'm going to condense it down to one slide for the purposes of this one. When you're writing and you're writing to a page and you're sort of writing the site as a whole, you should really keep in mind the kind of navigation how you're structuring the navigation on your site. So in case this example isn't too clear, I'm referring here to the on many sites the horizontal navigation at the top here, as well as the sidebar here. Some sites, as you probably know, omit the horizontal navigation and just have the navigation in the side. It's really key to keep menus to below, I'd even say below 8 items. I would revise that down a bit from what I'd originally written here. Because basically a well-structured navigation where everything on the site is categorized in a way that makes sense to people can really cut down on the sort of effort that people need to put in order to find what they're looking for. But if the sort of categories, the sections, get larger than about 7 items, it becomes very difficult, just first of all, just to read through them, and second of all, to sort of keep them all in mind and try to figure out which one of these sections applies to me. So here, this is coming from, I think, the About McGill site, is a good example of a good length menu where you can pretty quickly get through that, and depending on what you're looking for, you'll probably be able to find it in there. Obviously, you want to group similar items together. Going back to talking about writing for audiences and keeping audiences in mind frequently, that's how we'll split up a site, is we'll have a section for undergraduate students with information specifically pertaining to them, and with nothing under there that a graduate student would need, unless it's clearly indicated somewhere else. And, of course, it's essential to choose page names and menu titles that give clues about the content of the pages, because, obviously, somebody's not seeing what's on the page before they click on it. Any questions about that? Okay. I'm going to sound like a broken record. There's more about this on the Web 101 site. This is just a 45-minute long commercial for that new site. I think you guys are starting to realize that. But as well as thinking about navigation, it's very important to think about search. A majority of traffic to the McGill site as a whole comes from search, an overwhelming majority. And in general, about 60% or more of visits to any given site. So if you're the applying to McGill site or the Faculty of Arts site, it doesn't matter. About 60% or more of the visits to your site probably start somewhere other than your homepage. People aren't always going through in this way. As much as we do need to accommodate for people going in through here and structure the architecture in a way that makes sense, we also have to keep in mind that not everybody's going to have that context. Because, yeah, very simply, you don't know how somebody got there. They might have gotten there through a search. They might have gotten there through a direct link to a page. So it's important to keep context in mind. Any questions about that? It's sidebars and images also play a very important role. Sidebars being the sort of right-hand area for blocks like this, and images I think are self-explanatory. Very wide pages are bad for readability. I don't have the numbers at hand, but generally sort of mid-width pages are the easiest for people to scan because their eyes aren't moving back too much. And it has to do with how people read. Adding a sidebar will bring down the width of the page and makes reading it a lot easier on people's eyes. It's not something that people will consciously notice, but it can it takes a toll on sort of their attention. Images can also be eye-catching and can help to break up a page, and also in some cases reduce the width. Okay, any questions? Excellent. All right. So the bottom line, when you're writing for the web, the most important thing is to cut it down into digestible chunks. Don't use unnecessary words. That should be obvious. And cut out sort of jargony speak that won't mean much to your audiences. Keep your sentences and paragraphs brief and to the point. And use headers and subheaders to structure your content. Use bulleted lists to bring out stuff that's important and works well in that format. And short one-topic paragraphs for everything else. The bottom line is that you need to convince users that your site is worth their time, including easy-to-find information that's specifically relevant to them, and making it easy for users to find additional relevant information so that they stay, assuming that that's what your goals are. Those are kind of the principles, guidelines, and strategies that we use when we're working on websites, and we think they will work quite well for you as well. Does anybody have any questions on that whole presentation? We've got plenty of time, so don't be shy.
Could you roll that back so I can see the second last slide?
Sure.
The ones before the... Oh, thank you.
Sure. I can leave that one up.
Yes? Can you define what is an according in that?
Yes. I'll bring this up again in just...
30 seconds after that's fine. Okay. Are they in here? So this is an example of an accordion slider. Our tabbed content is not on here. Oops. I'm sorry. I usually have a very good example of this. This is one example where I think it's been used quite well, integrating tabbed content, because this is sort of all information that's sort of at the same level of the hierarchy. It wouldn't make much sense necessarily to have that sort of in a hierarchical order on the page. Okay, let me bring that slide back up for... That was clear? Excellent. Yes?
Where would you say the best place for a donate now button would be on a page?
That depends. probably right at the top.
Okay.
In...
not knowing much of the context here, this kind of seems like an instance where the idea is to spur action, that action being to donate. I think that it would make the most sense to put it up in, probably in the sidebar area.
Okay, so underneath the main image, but still at the top? But
yes, well, I mean, the sort of boundaries of a page start below the banner image and the horizontal navigation, if the site has that. I'd probably recommend in the sidebar there. Okay. I'm going to bring up the... it looks like we're good. If you're interested in learning more, the Web 101 site that I have been aggressively plugging for this entire lecture... is at www.mcgill.ca/web101. I think it will provide a very useful resource for anybody who's working with the web management system. It also has our contact information on there, as well as the kind of services that we can provide. I should mention too that our unit is not cost recovery. All of our communication services are completely free to members of the McGill community. It's mostly a matter of fitting you into our admittedly busy schedule. But if you have any questions at all, if you can, you can drop us a line at the email address that's up on that site, as well as I hope everybody got the very important that everybody writes down the I also take care of Google Analytics, so I'll be able to see if you guys visit that page. So if you need further guidance beyond sort of what I've covered in this lecture, I called it a lecture again, we can probably help. We offer one-on-one consultative support where we can sit down with you and talk about your website and your web communications strategy generally. As I mentioned, we offer Google Analytics reports for McGill sites as well. We also offer usability testing through a tool called Loop 11, which is extremely interesting, extremely useful for gauging sort of how users are actually using your site. The tool allows us to basically set goals for people and see how they complete those goals. So whether that's finding information or registering for something, we can see what pages they go to, what path they follow, and how long they take to do it. And more. We work on a lot of aspects of web communication, so if you have any questions, get in touch with us at webcoms@mcgill.ca, and if we can't provide an answer, we can hopefully direct you to someone who can. This slide is redundant because I haven't stopped talking about this the entire time, but Web 101 just launched yesterday. I think there's going to probably be an email going out about it sometime this week to site editors. It's full of useful tips and guidelines for making a good McGill website, and slides and a recording of this lecture will probably be posted there in about a week, along with links to the recordings for some other lunch and learns that I've given on Google Analytics, information architecture, and the version of this talk that I gave last year. So, any further questions? Excellent. Well, thanks everybody for showing up. I'll be sticking around for a few minutes. Thank you. I'm going to stick around for a few minutes here if you want to come up and ask questions in person.